Welcome, instigators, inciters, rabble-rousers, mischief-makers, and provocateurs. I'm Grant Faulkner, Executive Director of NaNoWriMo, which serves the purpose of helping thousands of people instigate, explore, and sometimes resolve all sorts of life conflicts each year. And I'm joined by my co-host, Brooke Warner, who also specializes in bringing conflicts to life, you might say. And Brooke, it's a bit odd to characterize ourselves and our communities as conflict-oriented, but it's true, right? Because stories are fundamentally about conflict or the conflict that arises between a desire and an obstacle.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny that we should be talking about this right now because I just started working with two novelists and I was already working with a third, and all of their books have the same fundamental issue, which is that there's little to no conflict. And as such, there's little to nothing at stake. And it's somewhat fascinating to me because I wonder if I suddenly manifested these authors because there's so much other conflict in my life right now, or if there's somehow an abundance of authors who are just wanting to write feel-good stuff to avoid the abundance of conflict we're facing in the world right now. But regardless, the result has me exploring with them about what can be at stake in their stories. And so we're talking about the fact that something actually needs to happen. There needs to be an inciting incident. And readers want to read about things that feel applicable to their lives, but that are also worth continuing to read. And feel-good stories, of course, are totally fine, but that has got to involve characters' growth, which can only be experienced through hardships and challenges and obstacles. And then the feel-good part can be about the resilience and the coming together and the overcoming the odds. So that's my take on it. Do you find conflict to be a challenge for writers in general, Grant?
Yeah, it's I don't know about in general, but it's interesting to me how writers, including myself, are often challenged by creative conflict in a story, and then the even more challenging thing to have the stakes of that conflict rise as the story progresses. And I've talked to writers who are hesitant to actually put their protagonists through a lot of hardship and suffering because they actually love them and like them so much. So it's interesting to me because we might be conflict averse as people, and I certainly am, but we have to be conflict enthusiasts on the page. And I often think of a quote by Nabokov, who, when I read this, I was quite startled by it. I think I read it when I was in my mid-20s. And he said he's a sadist with his characters. He likes to hold them under his thumb and punish them. And that's what happens in so many stories that we love. A character wants something, but then in their quest to get it, they face increasingly harrowing hardships. And I like this quote by James Scott Bell, who we had on Right Minded last year, I believe. And he said, "We're not here to make things perfect. Snowflakes are perfect. The stars are perfect. Not us. We are here to ruin ourselves and break our hearts and love the wrong people and die." So, but that sums it up nicely for me, because conflict is what drives a story. And without opposition, the story becomes lifeless. So as writers, we have to remind ourselves to ramp it up and push our conflicts to the outer limits. I'm curious though, Brooke, since you work with memoirists in particular, do you see the same challenge? You know, writers who either want to avoid the conflict or don't go deeply enough into it, or maybe have a tough time even identifying it.
Oh, Lord, yes. I see writers who are scared to death of hurting people they love, even people who are dead. Another thing that happens for memoirists is that they take on an ascribed role in their family. So they were the perfect son, or they were the peacemaker, or they were the dutiful daughter, or they're the decent guy or the good girlfriend, whatever it is. And if the memoir challenges the writer to step outside of that role, it can be and is really tough. So because some people may not be as self-aware or psychologically astute as is necessary for memoir, or it can take time to get there, this is something that can be a real growth edge for certain writers. And I've worked with memoirists too who are upholding a family value or sometimes a family fantasy about being a special family or a good family or the family who's the envy of all the other families. And these memoirs are, of course, super boring to read. But there are writers who are really trying to memorialize something that's more about a vision of what's important to them than what's true. So sometimes people don't realize that they're doing this. Sometimes it takes a while to get past that place and into a more grounded and true reality. And I have known writers who have scrapped their entire memoirs to try to work through those conditionings that they need to overcome. So this question of sorting out your truth versus what you wish the truth could have been, or the picture that you want people to show versus what is actually real, is something that memoirists really have to grapple with big time.
Yeah. Well, our guest today, the writer Melanie Abrams, actually has this great exercise for developing conflict that I'm just going to mention here. I'm going to take it to a new level in today's takeaway. But I did it once when she read at our local Nano Litmo reading series, and I thought it was really good for any writer and really good to think about. The exercise is that you write a name of a song on a 5x7 note card, you know, sort of a big note card is better actually than a little tiny one, and you hand it to another person, and that's the prompt for the story. And then you have to write a story on the note card, and it has to include conflict, a rising action to a crisis, and resolution. So essentially a beginning, middle, and an end. And the emphasis of the exercise is just to introduce the conflict early so that you don't meander for 10 pages and then introduce the conflict, you know, later. So it's all about getting that conflict on the first page of your story or novel, which is like really important. You know, I'm kind of curious, do memoirs have the same sort of story structure in mind? Do they need to get that conflict introduced very early, or can they meander to set up the context of the story more?
I mean, it's a good question because it, of course, depends on the story. I think it's an individual matter depending on the particular author and how they tell their story and what the story is. Because the three writers I mentioned earlier who are struggling with conflict in my coaching practice right now are all writing novels, right? And I've worked with memoirists who get to the conflict too soon, where you're like, whoa, we don't even know anything about you, and you're showing us something super intimate and it's too much too soon. So it is a question oftentimes of pacing and also structure. And I'm thinking about Mary Carr's memoir, The Liars Club, because pretty early on in that book, she gets into this super intense episode where her mom threatens to kill her. And obviously that's an inciting incident, but in Mary's telling of it, it's kind of vague because she's a kid when it happens. And so as a reader, you don't fully understand what happened to her mother that night, only that she gets carted off to the mental hospital after the incident. And then it takes nearly 300 more pages, almost the entirety of the book, for Mary to circle back around to that night again. And at that point, the reader has a lot more information and a lot more compassion for the mother. And I taught this book, we talked about it as a circular structure because the entire book centers around this central conflict that Mary keeps circling. But she needed to make sense of it for herself in the book. And she uses pacing and structure to let the reader get to know her mother and her family dynamic. And then she builds up the mother's character and then brings a true generosity to this mother who nearly killed her. And I think that's another key to good conflict writing, that you present even the most flawed characters in their fullest expression of humanity, you know, that you attempt to understand what drives them, and then you interpret what you know for the reader. And these are fundamental responsibilities of a storyteller that sometimes get lost or fumbled or misunderstood or ignored. And when a reader fails to attend to those responsibilities, the story can feel very laborious to read. And I, for one, have read a lot of stories like that. So I think getting this right is really a responsibility that writers can take on.
Yeah, and I love that circular structure that Mary Carr uses. I often think that, you know, you want to have your ending reflect the beginning in some way. That's what makes it feel whole. And I think some of the best stories are also the ones where there are different layers of conflict kind of speaking to each other in the story. And I made a short list of types of conflict just to kind of explore this a little bit. And you can probably come up with a much longer list than this, but I think these are the basics of like a story is either about a person against a person, like if you were the protagonist, Brooke, and I was the antagonist, for instance, that never happened, of course, or a person against nature, like Old Man and the Sea, or a person against themselves, actually, a kind of self-drama, self-conflict, a person against society, like the novel The Handmaid's Tale, or a person against a machine, like Terminator. And so in Melanie's book, one thing I admire about it is the way that she layers in conflicts of her protagonists against another, against themselves, and against society, which just makes the story really rich. And it's interesting to me as a literary fiction author, mainly, that Melanie, you know, she writes literary fiction, but she says it lives on the borders of genre fiction. And that made me think of this quote from Dean R. Kuntz, because so many literary fiction writers don't often place plot at the central place in their stories. And Kuntz says somewhat aggressively, he says, authors of so-called literary fiction insist that action, like plot, is vulgar and unworthy of a true artist. Don't pay any attention to misguided advice of that sort. If you do, you will very likely starve trying to live on your writing income. Besides, the only writers who survive the ages are those who understand the need for action in a novel. And I agree with him in the sense that every story needs action, escalation, and momentum, no matter if it's experimental literature or an adventure tale. And all of that arises from conflict, which we all need to pay attention to no matter what genre we write in.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing that quote from Dean R. Koontz to end on. I'm sure you've heard about this conspiracy theory online that Koontz predicted COVID-19 in his 1981 book, The Eyes of Darkness, in which he writes about a biological weapon called Wuhan 400. And for a few days, this was everywhere, and people have since picked it to death, and it turns out he didn't predict coronavirus. That said, I wouldn't have put it past him. And I am a Koontz fan from way back. And Watchers was probably like the first mature book I ever read in the seventh grade. And his books certainly have a lot of conflict. So that aggressiveness comes from clearly a sense of passion and conviction. And if you're looking to brush up on conflict, thrillers are a good place to get some tips. And I, for one, am still feeling quite unconflicted about talking about more conflict. So I think it's time to turn to Melanie, and we will do that right after this short break.
Brooke, I've been trying to look for gifts that this pandemic can give us, and I've been reading more books, which is great. And I've also been learning more in general because I've been enjoying the Great Courses Plus, who we're lucky to have as a sponsor. Great Courses Plus is similar to Right Minded in that it aims to expand curious minds, build a variety of skills, build self-confidence, and much more, of course.
Yeah, it's definitely designed for the lifelong learner in all of us. And I think the courses can help you as a writer, as a thinker, and a doer. And this streaming service provides access to thousands of fascinating lectures across almost any topic imaginable. And the courses are taught by world leaders, professors, and experts who explore topics like practicing mindfulness, learning how to watercolor, paint, or cook, or play the guitar, like Grant.
I've been learning how to play the guitar, believe it or not. And as you know, I like to listen while I walk my dog Buster. And I also have started watching courses during my lunch break at home, which is really great. And my son is now making a list of courses he wants to do this summer after graduating from high school, because he's going to be pretty much homebound for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and James and I are about to be the opposite of homebound, because we're taking off for a cross-country road trip to see my girlfriend on the East Coast. So we're going to be relying a lot on Great Courses. And I have a few queued up, but I'll take any recommendations you might have too, for myself or James.
Yeah, I'll have to think about for James. I was going to say, I want to recommend the course Great Utopian and Dystopian Works of Literature. I think it might be a little beyond him right now. But for you, it's great. It's a survey of genre, exploring, you know, everyone from Ursula Le Guin, Aldous Huxley, Octavia Butler, Philip K. Dick, Margaret Atwood, and more. I think it was really interesting for me to listen to it during these times, and the course has given me, you know, many story ideas and influenced what I'm writing right now, in fact.
I love to hear that. So everybody, continue your journey as a lifelong learner. Sign up for the Great Courses Plus. They're offering our listeners a free trial of unlimited access to their entire library. To start your free trial, sign up today using our special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded.
Don't wait for a second. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded. That's right-minded without a hyphen. One more time. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded. Welcome back, everybody. I'm thrilled to welcome my good friend, Melanie Abrams, who is the author of the novel Meadowlark, which is about the lasting effects of childhood trauma and the resulting choices we make for our children, a novel that just came out. And she's also written the novel Playing, and she teaches writing at UC Berkeley and is married to the writer Vikram Chandra. Welcome, Melanie.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a treat to have you on. And Melanie, I have a joke about myself as a writer. You know, one popular writing maxim is to never write a novel about a person walking around lost in his or her thoughts, because there's generally not enough conflict in such a story, or not enough at stake. And my joke, which is only, you know, really only partially true, is that I never saw a character I didn't want to write about walking around lost in thought. And so I was wondering, can you talk more about your ideas about narrative conflict, especially in literary fiction? Because sometimes I think people write literary fiction to do sort of an end run around plot and conflict. Well, not conflict, but plot more.
Yeah. No, yes. And I talk about this with my students all the time. They must feel like I'm hitting them over the head with a hammer with this. I think that most writers, particularly young writers, but also older writers, like you, we don't go into writing because we are dying to, you know, have some kind of very aggressive plot. Like, I feel like that's generally screenwriters do that. Like, first this is going to happen, then this is going to happen. But fiction writers end up going into writing because they're interested in why people do the things they do. And so we like ruminating in people's heads. And so I think a lot of the time the things that literary writers struggle with is that you got the internal conflict going on, but it's the external conflict that can be problematic. So as readers obviously want to be in characters' heads and process with them and feel connected to them. So the internal piece of it is obviously extremely important, but the external piece, I think, is just as important and what can sometimes get lost in literary fiction. So my whole thing is that, you know, the internal is obviously important, but the external needs to have like a driving force as well. And that usually follows this conflict crisis resolution thing that we all know. But I think the thing that I talk a lot about, and I borrowed this from Janet Burroway, who I think is genius at talking about conflict and how conflict short in a story, but she talks about the three D's, which is desire plus danger equals drama. And that's how you build conflict. And basically desire is what your character wants. Danger is what's getting in the way of that want. And if you do that, then you have drama, then you have conflict. So just making sure that that's externalized on the page so that you have both the internal and the external going on. Because otherwise you end up with what I call is like a French existential movie where you're just watching people sitting on a train thinking thoughts, which, you know, we all are happy to see one version of. What's that movie? Sunrise? What's that one called?
Oh yeah, Before Sunrise.
Before Sunrise, but more than one. That's enough. is enough.
Right. Well, to further this conversation about conflict, Melanie, you write about what might be seen as a sensory conflict of a sort in your new novel, Meadowlark, which is synesthesia, a neurological condition where some people essentially combine senses. So they might taste a color or hear an image. So what role does synesthesia play in the novel? And I'm particularly curious about it because I know that it's actually something that can serve as a writing technique as well, right? Where people combine the senses to try to spur inspiration and new ways of writing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, synesthesia is awesome. And actually, even though only 4% of the population have it, I'm always finding people that are like, oh, wait, I think I might have something similar to that. You know, it can come out in all kinds of different ways. In its most extreme form, there are people who say a word and then they can literally taste a taste on their tongue, and it's not necessarily the same taste. So like, for example, if they say, someone says drywall, they'll taste like strawberries on their tongue. So it's this combining of senses. And for the novel, for me, that kind of, I have two characters that have it, one more than the other. The one that has it more than the other is she's a 5-year-old little girl, and it really can get in the way of just kind of normal life. I mean, there are kids that when they hear loud booms, they see like blinding white light. And it's, you know, just difficult to function. So in the novel, the mom is kind of helping her navigate the world, but she's dealing with this thing that is pretty difficult to manage. But the way that I was also interested in as a writer is that I think as writers, we are always trying to bring two senses together as metaphor. I mean, writers use metaphor a lot, right? So you're saying one thing is like something else, and that's kind of blending the two different senses together to give the reader an experience that they might not have had without that metaphor, having them see it in a new way. So I was interested in the synesthesia in narratively, but also kind of metaphorically, because I think that's what writers, you know, are trying to do. It's like the poor woman's synesthesia is creating metaphor for the readers.
That's funny. Yeah. It's a conflict of the senses.
Right.
And, I want to keep talking about conflict as one who is basically writing French existential novels in black and white. one of the big topics in Meadowlark is motherhood, especially in regard to alternative ways of raising children, such as removing them from the real world into a type of supposed utopia. And then it's interesting to me in the novel as well, how you show cycles of parenthood and trauma and how a person might become the parent they wish they had, yet that might not work out so well either. So I'm just curious what drew you to this theme and how it plays out in Meadowlark as a conflict.
How being raised in a specific way makes you rebel against that way.
I guess that's a big question. I think it's really the cycles of parenthood are really interesting to me in the novel.
Right. Yeah. I think that, you know, I feel like I write about childhood trauma and how it affects the adults we become. Unfortunately, I don't think I can get away from that. So in this novel, particularly, I was interested in particularly mothers and mothers who've experienced their own traumas. And then, like you're saying, try and rebel against that way of being raised and do something completely different. But of course, as expected, that can go wrong as well. And so, you know, trying to heal ourselves through our children isn't always the best therapy for the self. Hopefully it does lead to better parents. I think all the parents in the book, or all the parents, like the main characters in the book, are better parents than their parents. But, you know, how we parent and what we choose to do with our children is loaded, and we're never able to completely get it right. And I think also the other thing I'd say is that as a writer, I think that I, you know, some of the traumas that we experience, as I think we all experience trauma, and the writers tend to go into writing because they're trying to heal whatever wounds they have, whether they're small or large. So I think that there's pieces of the book that are also me trying to, you know, kind of process my own childhood and make it work better on the page.
Yeah, thanks for that. It's interesting because there's like the being a child and reconciling all of that, but then there's also the being a parent, which brings a different type of conflict to the forefront, right? So we, of course, all are parents and know that writing itself brings challenges as a parent. And I don't know of a single parent who hasn't had to change how they write, when they write, and even question why they write, of course, because of being a parent. So what are the most significant ways you've changed as a writer because of parenthood? And do you see it as a conflict?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the practice of the writing, and then there's maybe the more internal piece of it. I mean, the practice of how I've changed as a parent writing, like when my kids were really little, I couldn't write at all, but I found that a little bit freeing. I think that there's two ways that writers who become parents deal with this. They're either like, if I don't write, I will go crazy, so I absolutely have to make this time for myself. Or there's what I did, which was, it felt very freeing to be like, I'm putting this aside for a couple of years and just focusing on this child. And there was something kind of relaxing about that, because for me, it had always been like, I'm either writing or feeling like guilty for not writing. So being able to kind of put it on the side was great when they were very little. And then, you know, once they went to school, I was able to get back to more of a schedule, which is like teaching on 2 days, writing on 3 days. But, you know, it never feels like enough. And I think internally, though, like not the practice of writing, I've changed as a writer in that, like my first book particularly, there's some kind of pretty intense themes that are, there's no actual overt child abuse, but it kind of dances around that. And I wrote that before I had kids. So I'm not 100% certain how I would feel about writing that now. I mean, this book definitely has childhood trauma in it as well, but it's not quite as overt. So I always think about that, like, would I be able to have written that book now once I've had kids? So I think it does change the way that you think about what you're writing about and the themes that you're writing about.
Hmm. Well, Melanie, I think the ultimate conflict as a writer might be when someone doesn't like what you've written. So steel yourself for this next question.
Okay.
It's, you know, and I want to preface it by saying that most of the reviews I've read of Meadowlark have just been over the top glowing, you know, from Kirkus to Publishers Weekly to almost all of the Goodreads reviews. But I also know how, you know, glowing reviews, I think one of the tough things as an author is you can receive like amazing glowing reviews, and all of those can be swept away by just a single negative comment, even from somebody you don't even know. And even a comment on Goodreads, for instance.
Right.
So I'm just gonna put you in the hot seat here and read this comment. And I just want to get your take on it as an author. So this comes from somebody who received the book as a pre-release from Amazon Prime. So she didn't exactly go out and buy it, but she says, I'm normally a super fast reader, but this took me a few days because I just didn't enjoy a bit of it. All of the characters were annoying and completely unlikable with no redeeming features. I only carried on reading until the end in case there was some kind of twist at the end that would make the book worthwhile, but there really wasn't. I tried so hard to like this book, but if anything, it just irritated me and left me feeling profoundly annoyed that I'd wasted 3 days of my life. And I'm so happy that you're laughing because I think that this is the right response when you read a review like this. It's just kind of like, why did somebody write this? But I don't know. What is your reaction? Do you find this helpful? Do you find it soul crushing?
No, you know, it's funny. I have found reviews soul crushing before, but not that one because it's just so over the top and funny that it's, I don't know, I feel somehow buoyed by it. I think anyone who says that there's no twist at the end when there's like a cataclysmic standoff between the government and a cult is probably, you know, has their own issues. But I just love also that that review managed to combine everything that you don't want to hear about your characters in one. Unredeemable. What was it? Unlikable.
Unredeemable. Unlikable. Yeah. Irritating. Annoying. Right. Yeah, but she read it all. She read the whole book.
And it took her a whole 3 days.
I know. That's much faster than I read.
I know, right?
I want to close. I want to mention, though, that the review that's very nestled very closely to that one, somebody writes, I honestly couldn't put this book down, but night after night, I forced myself to because I didn't want it to end. The character spoke to me on a deep level. So there you go.
Oh, I'll take that.
Well, and we have one more question for you, Melanie, which is, we know that you did a lot of research for this book, and I've heard you joke that the book was a way to rationalize pleasure researching. So how much did the idea for the book guide the research, and how much did the act of researching actually change the idea for the story?
Right. That's a great one. So two kinds of research that I did as to cults, and, you know, one was reading books, watching movies, et cetera, et cetera. And those are the stories you get that are just like the horrific tales of child abuse and, you know, people who have their money has been taken and they feel imprisoned. And so that was interesting to conceptualize internally. But then the in-person interviews that I did with people, a lot of people in the Bay Area, which I was lucky to have to be in the Bay Area because it's kind of the, you know, nexus of communes and intentional community. So I ended up talking to quite a few people that were raised in those environments. And those people had pretty positive associations with their growing up. So it was interesting to try and take a little from both sides. I think that when I first started, I had this idea that there would be one quote unquote bad cult and one quote unquote good cult. But as I kind of went along, I was able to kind of synthesize that a little bit so that I hope that both of the cults that are in the book or intentional communities, I like to call them because it doesn't feel great to call them either of them cults. I think nefarious bad stuff happens in both of those places, but it's hard to label them as cults. So hopefully they're both more nuanced places because of the research that I did, both the reading and the viewing and the talking.
Thank you so much for joining us, Melanie. This has been a wonderful deep dive into conflict on various levels.
Thanks, Melanie.
Thank you, guys.
Stand by for a little bit more conflict with today's takeaway.
This week's takeaway is focused on conflict, and it's a two-part exercise, and I mentioned each part earlier, but I mean, hopefully you will take this to a new level. And part one is just, you know, sometimes I don't know how you start stories, but I start stories just kind of randomly with a sentence that speaks to me or an image, and so I never really kind of sit down and really thoughtfully go through potential conflict. And so I thought it would be good for people to sit down and brainstorm different types of conflict within the types that I mentioned, which are person against person, person against nature, person against themselves, a person against society, or a person against a machine. And, you know, maybe spend a couple minutes with with any of those types, or choose one that especially speaks to you, and just do some freeform writing and just let yourself go to explore, you know, what types of conflict that you might be attracted to within those types of conflict. And then part two is then to do Melanie's exercise, which is to take the title of a song. You can pick this out if you're not doing it with another person. If you're doing it with another person, pick the name of a song and write it on a 5x7 note card and hand it to them or to yourself. And then write a story, which will fill the note card on one side, and it has to have a conflict, rising action to a crisis, and a resolution. So all in that tiny space, and that'll force you to, or help you introduce conflict early in your story. And I'll say that this is also a really good exercise to write a tiny flash fiction. Like, this is about a 100-word story, which I love to write those. So yeah, exercise in conflict today, and we hope your stories are rich in many, many, many different types of conflict.
Yes, we certainly do. And everybody, Right Minded is a weekly podcast, and we hope we've inspired you to, kind of get angry and maybe aggressive and bring a little bit of conflict to the page. It's actually a great outlet, so give it a try. But when you go to review us, which we are asking you to do, please don't be aggressive and angry. We like good reviews and we would love to hear from you. We do ask for these a fair amount, but the reason is because it helps us find new listeners, and we need that to stay on the air, especially during these times. So thank you. That is one small kindness you can do. We'll see you next week and every week, and we're very grateful for you. Thank you.